Good afternoon, everybody. I'm going to introduce myself. So my name is Rose White, and I am a sociology PhD student in New York City, but I'm also a knitter, and I have been for over 15 years, and I owned a small yarn store in Brooklyn called Yarnivore. And when I saw the call for papers for this conference, they mentioned guerrilla knitting. And when I put in a proposal for the other talk that I gave, I mentioned, well, if you like, I could give a talk on guerrilla knitting. And Jens and some of the other people said, yes, yes, please. So here I am. And thank you. As you'll see, the history of guerrilla knitting is actually very short, and it's entertaining, and I'm going to present that to you with some pictures that are very fun. But in preparing the talk and over the last few days and thinking really hard about being here and points of comparison between the two worlds, I decided that I wanted to add some more material that I thought would be very interesting for everyone, whether you knit or not. So let's get started. Here's a good example of what people are doing in terms of guerrilla knitting, just knit graffiti. So here's a sign welcoming people to Manhattan that has a beautiful piece of knitting on it. And I this is in Chicago. And somebody has knitted on a tree and decorated it with a flower. I believe it's a dead tree. And so now they have made it much prettier. This is in, this is in New Zealand. And this is somebody's photographs of a bunch of different tags that they found in their area. This one's my favorite. This is in Stockholm. And I love the images of the knitter putting together the piece and putting it on the anchor. I'm going to talk for a little while. I'll leave that up. So almost every time I've told somebody that I would be talking about knitting at the C3 conference, they've been very surprised. And they said, well, do you really mean knitting? Or maybe you mean networking? Or is there a translation problem? And so, no, obviously I am talking about knitting. But I do want to expand from guerrilla knitting to talk about geek knitting, and also to look at how the development of knitting over the last few centuries has a number of important parallels between with the development of hacking and also open source programming. So, very recently, just in the last 10 or 15 years, the internet, first through the mailing list called the Knit List, and then through blogs and websites, has changed the experience of modern knitters and is exposing tech people, conceptual artists, and other geeks to knitting at the same time that it's exposing knitters to all of our weirdness in ways that they hadn't really gotten a chance to see before. Knitting itself is not very old. There are sort of folkloric things that people say about knitting, like, oh, we've been knitting for tens of thousands of years. And that's just a lie. People have actually only been knitting since the Renaissance. There's some examples of fabrics that look knitted, but when they're taken apart, they're actually done with a technique called nalbinding, which is a sort of Scandinavian technique involving multiple strands of yarn and what looks like a darning needle. And so that's not what we think of as knitting, where there's a single strand of yarn that makes up the entire garment. And the thing that's interesting about that from a computing point of view is that when knitting developed, it was proprietary knowledge. So the transmission of the knowledge of knitting happened really from sort of the Middle East and then along the same lines that brought classical learning back to Europe in the Renaissance. And then in Italy, there were knitting guilds. So if you want to think about them, the guilds as being like trade unions, or as being like certificate programs saying that you're certified in a particular language or in a particular, you know, networking technique. There were these guilds, and they very heavily, they kept their knowledge very secret. And so knitting was not something that people did at home. Knitting was something that men did for pay. And they did this for, you know, the Queen of England, or for important people in their province. But as it turns out, knitting isn't very hard. And so people were able to reverse engineer knitting. And so that knowledge that had previously been proprietary and kept in guilds, got dispersed into the community. So as we so often say, you know, if you build something and you put DRM on it, people are just going to break it. And so if you put knitted objects out in the world, somebody can look at that knitted object and figure out how it's made. And as Elizabeth Zimmerman says, knitting isn't hard. All you need to become a good knitter are wool, needles, hands, and slightly above, below average intelligence. Of course, superior intelligence, such as yours and mine, is an advantage. And I will come back to Elizabeth Zimmerman a little later. So at that point, just after the Renaissance, just as the Industrial Revolution was beginning, knitting sort of had two divergent paths. So knitting frames and knitting machines allowed knitting to be something that could just be purchased, that would be produced industrially. But also homemakers, usually women and children, learned how to knit so that they could do things themselves. And they were usually making socks or mittens or other very small things. They weren't really making like sweaters and larger garments. Ganzes, the sweater on the left, and the Aran sweater on the right, those were developed in the late 19th century. Fair Isle knitting developed sort of at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century. Again, in terms of folklore, you could actually find printed in reputable-seeming books up until 10 or 20 years ago, stories about how Aran knitting had existed for centuries, and that the different cables were how families would identify their drowned sailors at sea. And so this idea that these cables were a kind of code that families had knitted into the garments. And so it's all completely false. So when people talk about Wikipedia not being reliable, you know, these were books published by Random House and other, you know, presumably reputable publishers. That's all been disputed and revised, and so we have a clearer history of knitting now. So there are these beautiful Fair Isle sweaters knit in two colors. I'm gonna put the pretty picture back up while I talk for a moment. Over the course then of the next like 50 years, one thing that happened is that there was still a small tradition of this home knitting where knowledge was passed on between individuals. But there were also publications that tried to codify knitting patterns. And there was a sort of trend toward trying to make the patterns as distinct as possible, and also to make them proprietary. And so knitting patterns were widely published by the yarn companies, but for their specific yarn, they would withhold any information that would help a knitter make an object in another yarn. So information that you might need would be, how many meters are there in a ball of this yarn? That wouldn't be printed on it. How many total meters of yarn do you need to make the project? They wouldn't tell you. They would say, you need 8 balls of our yarn named Zephyr to make a project. How many stitches you would knit to each inch, which is gauge, and which would let you figure out how to size your pattern, they would withhold that information as well. And so this is a very proprietary system where they would say, using our yarn and using these size needles, cast on this many stitches and do it exactly the way we tell you. And so over a period of decades, the commercial knitting industry managed to alienate millions of knitters from the understanding that they were in possession of the means and the mode of production. So these are the sort of things that were available, and you can see that this is Bear brand yarn. And the patterns that would be included here would say, you know, use our yarn. And then by the 60s, most available yarn was acrylic or polyester. It wasn't wool or cotton or other things that are actually nice to touch. So then there was another schism in knitting. At the sort of end of the 60s, beginning of the 70s, modern Western feminists decided that knitting was a tool of the patriarchy, and that women were being kept down by housework and by handicrafts, and that this sort of thing was something that just wouldn't do, and that they didn't want to have anything to do with it anymore. At the same time, there was a different movement going on with the Whole Earth Catalog, Mother Earth News, a publisher called Interweave Press, and so hippies actually kept some knowledge of knitting going at the same time that feminists were saying, no, we don't want to have anything to do with it. So there was actually a spinning wheel that you could buy from the Whole Earth Catalog. And they sold, they gave information about where to buy knitting and other textile supplies. At this moment, we have a heroine who sort of steps in. And we can really call her an geek. Her name is Elizabeth Zimmerman. And she's the woman on the left there. And I apologize, this is not the geekiest picture that exists of her. There's a lovely picture of her knitting while riding on the back of her husband's motorcycle that I really wanted to bring you, and I couldn't find it anywhere. I know that I've seen it, and now none of us can remember what book that's in. So she was commissioned to make a sweater early in her professional knitting career. And it was an Aran sweater, like the white cabled sweater I showed you before. And she did a wonderful job of it, and it was knit all in one piece using traditional knitting techniques. And when she gave it to the company that had commissioned it, they rewrote the pattern. And they rewrote it so that it would be knitted in four pieces and using the kind of proprietary language that I discussed before. Whereas her feeling was that, you know, you can substitute whatever yarn you want, and you can do it however you want. And she was disgusted by this process of them taking her intellectual property and screwing it up. And then, you know, they kept her name on it, but she was really pissed off. And so she started her own publishing company. And she would tell people that you are the boss of your knitting, and you can make your knitting do anything you want it to do. Which was a very different message than what people were getting from other directions. In her knitting patterns, she would talk about blind followers and thinking knitters. And so she would say that if you really needed her to, she would write out a pattern for you with all of the numbers in it. But what she preferred to do was to write a pattern that said, using your own yarn, knit up a little swatch, figure out what it does, figure out how many stitches an inch you get, figure out what you're going to make with it, and then here are some ways to design your own pattern, which is a very hands-on kind of idea that you control what's going on. And when you think about it, you're taking needles and string and stitch by stitch constructing a garment. There's no reason why you shouldn't have absolute control over that entire process. And that's something that had been taken away from people. The comparison that I'd like to make really is between Linux and Windows. And so I think of Linux as being a folk culture. Certainly my own exposure to Linux has been, you know, learned by word of mouth and mailing lists and websites. I'm going to admit now, actually, that it's embarrassing to me. My home machine runs Ubuntu. And my hard drive failed the day before I was leaving. And I borrowed this very pretty little laptop from a friend who's a sysadmin, but I said, everybody's going to make fun of me, it's running Windows. So, in any case, so Linux, in all its different versions, as we all know, is a folk culture. And you learn tricks by watching other people work. And what happens with Windows, I think, is that you give people very powerful machines. You know, people buy laptops, they buy desktop computers, and they're incredibly powerful objects. And then you take away all the power from them, and you say, no, you have to do it the way that we want you to do it. Here is how you can do this thing. And people forget that they even have any power because they believe that they have to do it the way that they've been told. So over the last, like, 30 years, over the period that I'm talking about, there have been different individuals who have contributed to this kind of geekier, more hands-on approach to knitting, kind of wresting it out of the control of commercial enterprises. And as I hope you can see, that does lead us to guerrilla knitting in the end. So Barbara Walker is really, I would like to call her a knitting engineer. She wrote four enormous books of stitch patterns. And in those books, she knit swatches like this, and she dissected them. She included written instructions for how to knit them, sort of stitch by stitch. And she also developed a charting pattern, a charting system, so that next to the swatch, there would be a grid showing you how to do it in pictures, so that you didn't even have to speak her language to do it, so that suddenly these knitting patterns were available not just to English speakers, but to anybody who could pick them up and look at them. So this enormous dissemination of knowledge occurred when she started doing that. This is a person who, Debbie knew, who's just doing extraordinary work. If I could spend time with one knitter and try to pick her brain about, like, how her mind works. This is a thing she calls labyrinth knitting. So as you can see on the left, it's just this pile of crap. And then on the right, if you lay out that as she has structured it, I don't have a pointer, but you can see there are all these little bends in the fabric. Those are knitted in. So in that thing on the left, I mean, this is sort of, this is like assembly programming. You know, you're doing this thing and you don't know what it's going to look like in the end. And then when you put it together, suddenly you have this object. And then you would sew all of those seams and you would have a square. On the left here is a sweater knit using that technique. And you can see you get this very complicated pattern going on in it that is exceptional and that has nothing to do with what we think of as being sort of linear knitting. Nora Gahn is a woman who's been using a lot of natural or scientific motifs in her knitting. And she's not just sort of stepping in and saying, like, oh, that looks pretty, I'd like to use it. She actually is a marine biologist who has become, you know, first it was by night she was a knitter, and now sort of by night she's a marine biologist because she's become very popular in the knitting world. This is made up of a series of hexagons that interlink so that these complicated cables are the points of linkage between the different pieces. And again, this is very non-linear. There's a tradition that's been growing of knitting things in Mobius strips. So this is a scarf that that is a Mobius strip. It has one edge. This particular example was knitted from the inside out. So starting at one bit and casting off on the end. When you're knitting that around, it is, for a knitter, very counterintuitive. It looks as though you've made a terrible mistake and that your sweater is, or your scarf is going to come out inside out and all wrong. But that makes it fun because it's confusing and it makes your brain work hard. And I think that the results are beautiful. They're actually very functional. It turns out that the Mobius strip used as a scarf drapes very well. So the topology helps there. I'm happy you like this image. This is a photograph actually taken by Phil Terone at a wonderful exhibit that was done at the Museum of Art and Design in New York City. One point that I think is especially interesting is that the Museum of Art and Design used to be called the American Craft Museum, and they changed their name because they felt that the word craft had developed sort of negative connotations and that they no longer wanted to be associated with that. And this is a thing that happened less than 5 years ago. And I feel like if they had just waited it out, that it would have been okay. That that craft really, you know, right now is retaking its sense of being skill and technique and not being, you know, just sort of, I don't know, tea cozies or something. Not that tea cozies can't be functional, but there was a lot of dispute about their decision to change the name. This is a gorgeous object. It covers a table that's about 6 feet across, and it is actually crocheted, which is an easier way to get these sort of three-dimensional shapes that the skulls are. And if I remember correctly, I think that the smaller motifs are all slightly different. Which, in the artist statement, the artist made a point of saying that, you know, this is not industrially produced, these things aren't exactly like each other. I have a choice to make where I can make these all be a little different. Dave Cole, yeah, isn't this awesome? This is his project. He knit, and as you can see, this is something that was featured on Make as well. Excuse me. In an American flag. This is at the Massachusetts Museum of Contemporary Art. It's two construction cranes, and I believe those are telephone poles. It took a whole day to do this knitting because constructing each stitch was incredibly time-consuming of this sort of ballet of coordinating the two cranes so that they could go in and bring out this incredibly heavy fabric. One of the kind of physics aspects of this is that he had to figure out what material he could use that would support its weight, because on this scale, that becomes an issue. And as you can see, it still does drag quite a lot. It's not sort of compactly knit. Another project of his that I adore are these teddy bears that he knits. This one is made of lead. The object itself is about a foot tall. And I wish I could remember what it weighs. Obviously, you weren't allowed to pick it up. But it was, I'm told, enormously heavy. And obviously also poisonous. One of the things that he's been enjoying doing is working with this idea of things that are knitted, and that give off an idea of being sort of cozy and comfortable and yet are subversive. So this is a poisonous teddy bear. He knit an enormous one using the same pattern, using fiberglass insulation. So it's a huge pink knitted teddy bear that's about 8 feet tall and about 6 feet across. And if you were to tumble into its welcoming arms, you would be covered in tiny cuts from the fiberglass. So again, another subversive object. I love the scarf. On the right is a pattern that was called Yorick that was featured in knitty.com, and an enterprising knitter decided that she didn't want a skull. She'd rather honor Cthulhu, so she'll get killed last. She did this and revised the pattern and gave it lots of little tentacles. This is a person who is putting patterns on Etsy, and I just really like all of his cephalopods. I think they're beautiful, and squids are the next pirates, so they're really fun. Here's some more weird stuff that people have been doing. There's actually a very small online museum of textile brain art. And the knitted brain on the left is my favorite of the pieces, although there's some beautiful other pieces as well. And then this knitted digestive system is really just terrific. The small intestine is, I don't know, it's charming in its kind of creepiness. This is a beautiful art project that somebody did for Burning Man. I'm not certain, I don't know if this was for 2006 or 2007. And so the artist wrote a pattern for how the leaves would be knitted. And she constructed this, not on site, but in her studio at home, and attached all of the leaves to the tree that she brought to the playa. And in the close-up, you can see how they're all made from different yarns and by different knitters. And her point was that when they were on the playa, the way they were constructed is that they were not bound off. So you could unravel each leaf. And this is a picture from sort of in the middle of the process where the knitting itself is being unraveled. And I love how it's sort of about ephemerality and... again, it just seems incredibly subversive to say, you know, we're doing this thing that you could use to clothe yourself, but we're just fucking with it for fun. And, you know, we're going to do this thing and then we're going to throw it away. But it's going to be really beautiful in the meantime. I love this picture. This is in Seattle. It's a statue of Lenin, and somebody knit him mittens. Based on what I was able to see on Flickr, it seems like the mittens have stuck around for a while. You know, I can't promise that those mittens are never going to get stolen, but it seems like people get that it's just really cool, and that it's this great prank, and that they want to leave them there. And, you know, that makes me really happy. Oh, thank you. Aw, I don't know if everybody could hear that. So a knitter informs me that the mittens do get stolen, but that there's a group of people who are continuously knitting mittens.
There's also a group of people in New York.
Oh, here, she can explain.
Who do it for the statues in New York. So there's kind of a subversive group all around the world that does knitted things on statues. There's a couple statues of horsemen in Central Park in New York. We've made knitted boots for the horses and scarves for the riders. It's quite hilarious.
So, that I can't tell you. You know, hippie liberal socialist Seattleites? I can't tell you. I don't know. But he does need red mittens, clearly. So the things that I want to finish up with are pointing out again that once you have control over what it is you're going to do with your tools, then you can be enormously creative and you're not constrained to do the things that you're told to do by society. And, you know, that might feel like a really trite point to make, especially in a crowd like this. But what I love so deeply is that this message is getting through to the knitting community, which is often thought of as being kind of stodgy. I mean, there are all these stereotypes, and believe me, any person who knits has heard all of them. You don't look like a grandmother, or what are you doing knitting? Don't you have anything better to do? And, you know, if you're soldering a TV be gone, do you want somebody walking up and saying, don't you have anything better to do? Like, couldn't you be putting together something productive? No, you want to do your fucked up fun thing yourself without a lot of interference. There's a few tech things going on in knitting right now that I want to mention, two in particular. There's a website called Ravelry.com. And it is an enormous relational database. And it's also a social networking site. What I have been interested by in the press is that when it gets mentioned, there's this sort of scoffing about why do knitters need a social site, completely ignoring the technical aspect of what it is that's been done. So this is a huge database that you can get at, since it's relational, from sort of any direction, that has patterns and yarns and projects people have made, the photographs they've taken of them, their notes on the patterns, who's knitting the patterns, and you can go from sort of any direction. So you can see what an individual has knitted, you can see what's been done by a certain designer, what products have been knitted in a particular yarn. And this amount of information suddenly being available to knitters is just an explosion. It's so exciting. I used to own a yarn store, as I mentioned, and yarn store owners know that if a pattern is printed and a sweater is shown in one color, that maybe 30% of the people who knit that sweater are going to ask for the yarn in the color the picture showed up in the magazine. It breaks your heart. You know that they could make it in any color they wanted. And they say, oh, but you know, it looks so nice there. It's lime green there. I want the lime green. And suddenly, with Ravelry, you have access to pictures of other people who've knitted the sweater in a whole rainbow of colors. And it's my hope that now that that's available, that people will be able, even if they couldn't make the leap themselves, to have it sort of borne in on them that there's more to what they're doing and that there's more opportunity for creativity than they'd been letting themselves have. There's a very new project just in the last few months called KnitML, so Knit Markup Language. And this is a serious project that somebody has taken on to try to standardize knitting patterns. There are differences in how knitting patterns are written globally. So even in English, so we like to say that in England or Canada or you know the former Commonwealth in the United States, that we're divided by a single language. And that's true even in knitwear. So if you look at a pattern for knitting or crochet, the terms are all different, which is ridiculous. And if you take that further and look at other languages, say German or Italian or Japanese, the standards for how patterns are presented are all entirely different. But as the person who's setting up KnitML has pointed out, the functions that we're doing, the actual tasks that we're taking on, are standard. And that if we could code the instructions in a standardized way, then that could then cause another burst of creativity. Once all of that information, again, is brought together, we can go from that and explode outward again, because we're suddenly able to talk to each other about what it is we're doing. I will add a page, because I forgot to put it out on a slide, with lots of links for you. So I'll give the slides to the C3 folks, and there'll be an extra page that's not up here now. That's just my information. So there are some terrific websites that I'd like to point you to. And if you're interested, I hope you'll look at the slides online to get a look at them. There's lots of information about how to knit on the internet. You can just pick up yarn and needles and learn how. And honestly, if any of you get yarn and needles over the next couple of days and you'd like to learn to knit, I would be happy to teach you. And I know that there are other knitters around, so if you sort of looked sad and had needles and yarn, you know, somebody would probably help you. And again, that's in contrast there's a sort of knitting industry, and this is one reason why I don't still have a yarn store, which thinks that they should charge hundreds of dollars for knitting classes, at least in New York City. And for something that you can learn how to do in 10 minutes, it's outrageous, and it's very upsetting. And it turns out that I'm not a very good capitalist. On that point, I'd like to end and see what questions people have, and if you have any thoughts about things that I left out, favorite geeky knitting products.
I wonder if you personally have any thoughts. I know recently online there was a huge furor over, there's a brand that has trademarked the name Stitch and Bitch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wonder if you have any thoughts on the commercialization of subversive knitting like that. I'm personally not a fan, and I kind of avoided that whole conglomerate of drama, but I wonder if you have any thoughts on it.
I do. And let me see if I can summarize for a group that might not know about that whole background. There is a book called Stitch and Bitch that a woman in New York City wrote and edited. And it turned out that some other company had trademarked the phrase Stitch and Bitch, which, again, is ridiculous. People have been using that term for their knitting groups for decades, and they sort of said, oh, well, we'll trademark it, and then nobody else can use it, and there was this huge kerfuffle about that. And as far as I know, Debbie Stoller is still able to use the phrasing for her books, but there's been some other stuff going on where, like, groups are told that they can't call themselves Stitch and Bitch groups. There's a second aspect of that, where the books that Debbie produced try to be edgy in a way that feels very much to me like somebody kind of co-opting edginess. So the example that a friend of mine gives is it really subversive to buy a book for $20 at the bookstore so that you can take a graph of an anarchy symbol to knit it on your hat? If you really wanted an anarchy symbol on your hat, wouldn't you just have made it up yourself? Like, it's not really hard to graph an A in a circle. There's sort of projects like that that seem to me to be like, oh, we want to be hip. And as you can tell from my tone of voice, that's what I think about it. I don't think it's particularly punk or geeky or
cool. Yeah, I mean,
cool.
There's also crafter.org that... They do basically the same thing, but better and more original-er. They're a lot better at it, but I wondered if anyone else had any thoughts on that. It's nice to hear similar thoughts.
Sure. I see that somebody else has a question, and that's a sort of similar topic, so why don't we... I'm sorry, you were standing there. I thought you...
All right. Over here.
Go ahead.
Is there kind of an obstacle to knitting right now, which you, I don't know, a point where you can't go further, where you need, I don't know, special yarn or something, you will overcome, or is there something hard that people are working on to tackle right now?
I'm not sure I understand the question. Do you mean about an individual project or just knitting?
I don't know. In programming, you sometimes I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. I appreciate
you have a
the
problem
question.
And you want to overcome it, like anonymizing your traffic mm-hmm. and such a thing. But this is only software related. Is there something to knitting where you would what you would like to have, but right now can't have?
Right. There's funny little things that do sometimes happen. Somebody, for instance, decided that it would be easier to knit socks not on four double-pointed needles, but using a long needle. And I could explain how that works, but it's a little tedious. But you pull out the cable, and so instead of switching back and forth between the shorter needles, you do this. But then that meant that you needed a very flexible knitting needle with a longer cable. And so, what's that? Yes, thank you. That's a very nice way to put it. It's mathematically congruent to doing it with four needles or doing it with one long needle. But then some people were kind of hacking together long cabled needles, and then some businesses stepped in and started producing long cabled needles. Sometimes there are things with certain aspects of yarn that come up where you want a yarn. For instance, there's superwash wool available now, so there's washable wool. And there was a sense before that wool was difficult to work with because you couldn't just put it in the washing machine. And now there's wool that's been treated so that it doesn't felt easily. And so then that's available. In terms of knitting patterns, I can't think of a thing that's a particular Mount Everest issue, but I know that people are always sort of pushing the boundaries of what it is that you can create with knitting, and it's pretty exciting.
Oh, okay. This is less of a question, but more of a comment. In case you are still looking for knitted objects,
sure.
You may be interested in an object that is an art object that was exhibited in Berlin a couple of years ago, but it was made by a French artist. It's called Volita, and it caused considerable protest by conservative Yellow Press. Mm-hmm. It's actually a knitted naked woman. You may mm-hmm. find it sexist or not, but just in case you're interested, you may Google it up or stuff, and yeah.
Feel free to email me, or I will Google it. That sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
There's a knitted tank cozy that, if I'd thought about it, I might have put. I mean, many of you may have seen that already on Boing Boing. So I was trying to not. There's two knitted tank cozies.
For both of them.
That's wonderful. So I was trying to not just use things that have been on Boing Boing. You know, because that's so easy to do. But there's a woman who makes knitted figures from movies. It's a wonderful sort of geek thing. Dawn of the Dead, also Shaun of the Dead. And so there's these little zombie knitted creatures, and they're beautiful. And so, you know, rather than painting miniatures, she's knitting them.
For people that have, like myself, two left hands, do you know of any fun things you can do with knitting machines?
I've only used knitting machines a little bit, and honestly, if the manual dexterity that it takes to run a home knitting machine is as high or higher than, I think, than learning to knit by hand. It's like any other physical task that you take on, it feels very awkward at first, and then there is a moment where you start to get the muscle memory in your hands, and you get the hang of it. But as for whether there are fun things to do with knitting machines, there certainly are. That's not a thing that I took on here, but you can do a sort of programming of images. And so you can take multicolored images and program them and make really enormous pieces of knitted art, which obviously would appeal to a lot of folks here.
The way I see it, computer programming and knitting are two incredibly geeky activities, both with very unhealthy gender ratios,
yes.
Let's say. Might be a stereotype, but do you see any hope in getting a healthier gender ratio in knitting?
I've seen a little bit of progress on that as there are more knitters online. And I think that because a man can out himself as a knitter online in that way that, you know, oh, nobody's like right there watching you. And so we talk about internet communication being anonymous. He isn't knitting on the train, he's knitting on the internet. And so I've been seeing a little bit. It's not much, but there's some. I was actually, and I forgot to put this slide back up, and I was annoyed to see this quote from the Knit a Please folks. This is their description of what it is they're doing, and that they did this in 2005. And at the end, they say Knit is a group of ladies of all ages, nationalities, and gender. And this is just taken off their website, and I'm like, what is it you're saying? it seemed odd for a group that was dedicated to subversive knitting to be sort of uninclusive or a sort of strange nod toward inclusivity. I'd love to see more guys knitting. I'd love to see more women programming. Maybe we can work out a deal. You know, just as much as when women show up at geek conferences, they get attention, men get attention from women knitters. So if that, you know, helps any of you want to learn to knit, more power to you. Think about it. There's a question in the back.
I was wondering why you didn't mention one point, which is also an intersection between knitting and hacking. I thought there's a piracy issue with knitting patterns for knitting machines.
Yes, they're for machines, but also for patterns in general. I debated about whether I was going to bring that up as a main point in the talk, but I'd be happy to mention it. I want to put up something pretty again. Here, I'll put that up again. So there's a lot of discourse in the knitting community about copyright, and a lot of it is very mushy-headed, just to be frank. So there are people who say, oh, you stole my sock pattern, and, you know, oh, I trademarked that, or I patented that, and people are just sort of tossing around words that they've heard about, like, oh, you can't steal my thing. But the process of knitting a sock, for instance, is actually not trademarkable or copyrightable. The exact language that you use to describe your pattern is, and so somebody can't publish, you know, they can't plagiarize your pattern, but somebody can look at your sock or your garment and reverse engineer it, and that's not illegal. It may, if the pattern is very distinctive, it may be immoral, but that's a different issue. And I've found fascinating the sort of ways that people talk about this in the knitting world. Many knitters, well, a percentage of knitters are starting to use Creative Commons licenses for their patterns, the ones who are aware of them, and that usually handles what it is they want to do, which is that they'd like attribution if somebody knits their pattern or uses it for something. But, you know, the dollar numbers are not high on, you know, just a pattern that you put out in the world. And really, I think people are more upset about attribution than they are about getting paid. There's also a problem with orphan works. So there's an enormous quantity of printed literature from the first half of the 20th century that is still in copyright due to American copyright laws being fucked up. A lot of that material can't get accessed because the companies that printed it are no longer in business. And so you can't actually get to a copyright holder to say, may I have permission to print your material? And that sucks. You know, even if I disparage some of those early knitting patterns, I think that they should still be available to people to learn from and to use. How are we doing for time? I see people going back and forth, so can a room monitor tell me how we're doing? There's a question up front.
You just said that publishing a pattern that you reverse engineered from a knitted object would not be a copyright infringement. Is that not still a derived work, derived two steps, first the object from the pattern and then the reverse engineered pattern from the object? I think legally that would still probably be seen as a derived work.
I do see your point. I'm not the person to ask for the really detailed answer on that. There are a couple. There's a woman whose blog is The Girl from Auntie, and she's a copyright lawyer and knitter who has spoken very clearly on some of these issues. And you're holding a nice object, so I didn't know if you were going to say something
this
about
it. This is a knitted companion cube for anyone who's played the game Portal. So my girlfriend made me this for Christmas. The design for this one is released under a Creative Commons license, and you can find it at knittedcompanioncube.blogspot.com.
Aww. It's really lovely. And yay, Creative Commons license knitting patterns. Well, I'm really excited about the talk. I mean, about your response to the talk, and I hope you were excited by the talk. It's been great being here, and I'm just so delighted that there's room at C3 for people who aren't the hardest core Linux hackers, but who have sort of other things to bring to the discussion. So thank you for coming.